Ladies, gentlemen, whoever's there, I think we're going to get started now. First of all, I want to thank, again, Torrent Motion, everybody involved there, for making this possible. And I'd like to thank everybody who came, took their time out of their evenings, to listen to what we're going to be discussing and hopefully to participate a little. Feel free to ask questions. The easiest way is chat. Type it in the chat or raise your hand. There's some way to do that. Or just chime in with your microphone if you want to. More than happy to have some input. The series that we're going through now is talking about recent books. And recent books is a vague topic and really gives me the ability to talk about anything I want, really, as long as I can somehow tie it into a recent book. What we're going to do tonight is really talk about one recent book, but to put it into context of a series of books over the past, say, 20 years. Actually, I'm sorry, the past 50 years. And that's Outreach Books. We're going to be talking about I've got some multimedia here in addition to the video and the audio. Now we actually have some pictures, which might help. So the main book that's recent that we're going to be talking about, and that's towards the end, is a book called Judaism: A Way of Being by David Gelernter. Hot off the press. I'm not even sure if it's officially been published. I got an advanced copy. And it's, you could call it an outreach book. And we're going to be putting it into context by talking about a bunch of other good outreach books and to discuss where Judaism, A Way of Being, fits into all those other books. And through that, we're going to talk about different ways of doing outreach that we could do in books, or we could do in person, or we could do online. And really, I'm trying to bring this discussion and universalize it beyond books, but we're going to be focusing on books. Now, if you think about how you do outreach, there are multiple ways of doing it, and mainly the way we do it personally is on a one-on-one basis, the people we talk to, the people we interact with, and we do it in person and verbally. But there are many other ways of doing it, and if you want to do it in a book, so then you have to strategize. How are you going to do it? And part of strategizing is, what is your goal? And I would just say, this is something that I learned when I was in Yeshiva University. So I was in the rabbinic program there for a while. I never finished that. I have ordination elsewhere. But in the first year of the program, every Friday morning, they have some outside speaker come to teach you about, just to speak about the different topics that for rabbis. And one of the speakers was talking about his adult education program, which you could call outreach. And he discussed his goals, and I thought it was very helpful. Because if you're a rabbi out in the suburbs, like Jay was talking about in the suburbs, and you give adult education classes, so you'll see a lot of people, most of the people, the vast majority of people who come through your program who start out not religious, are not going to end up being Shomer Shabbos, with the yarmulke, cutting the hair, whatever it is, keeping kosher, the whole thing. You rarely in your lifetime will you have such success stories. So the question is, what is the rabbi supposed to do? Is he supposed to feel like he's a big failure? Or does he have to think more carefully about what his goals are? And what I learned from that class, which is, you know, I think if you talk to rabbis who went through the rabbinic program, you won't hear too much that they learned from those classes. But what I learned from that one class is that the real goal you have to set in outreach is to change someone's life in any way is possible. Bring them a little closer to Judaism, a little closer to God, a little closer to religion. And that itself you could call a success. If they do one more mitzvah, if they come to shul more often, or even if they just think a little more about who they are and why they're here in this world, that alone is a success. Now, if you define success that way, it's easy to have a lot of success. And most rabbis have many successes. So when we talk about an outreach book and what your goal is, if your goal is to touch people and to reach people and make them think more, well, that's a different type of book than if your goal is to make someone 100% Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Torah mitzvahs, and go off to Kollel in Israel. So, you know, that fits into what we're trying to do also. Now, a few weeks ago, one of my friends who is an educator in yeshiva, he's a rabbi in yeshiva, so he asked me to put together a list of outreach books for him because he has a student that he thinks is relevant, so he wanted just a long list of all the outreach books I would recommend. So what you see here on the screen is not the full list, not at all. It's a subset of the list that we're going to talk about. Daniel, you'll see in a minute what book we're talking about. Jay made a big point that part of saving the world is changing yourself. So you could say outreach is really inreach. And that's actually the Vilna Gaon strategy of doing outreach. And he pictured it, or he described it in this way. Let's say if you want to fill, you have five little cups and you want to fill them up. One way of filling them up is to take a bottle and pour into all the five little cups, and then you'll fill up each cup. The other way is to take a big cup, put it in the middle, fill it till it's overflowing, and then let that overflowing fill up the smaller cups. And that's two different ways of doing outreach. One is to reach out to all the small cups and try to fill them up, try to teach to people who are not observant and maybe not that learned. And the other way is to fill yourself up, fill the observant community to so much that it's, they're overflowing with goodness and kindness, that everybody wants to be like them and everybody wants to emulate them. And then mimela, just incidentally, people will start becoming more observant and more closer to Judaism just by witnessing all these overflowing cups, so to speak. We're talking about different outreach books, Daniel. We're going to end up with Judaism, A Way of Being, which is number 5 on the list. But first we have to start. The first book I want to talk about is called The Eye of a Needle. Actually, the name has changed. It used to be called The Eye of a Needle. And that's what I'm speaking from, the 1993 book. As you see, there's a 2005 edition also, which I don't have. I didn't even know this until today when I looked up on the... We tried to get an image of the cover on the internet, and what I came up with was all I could find was the cover of the second edition, which is pretty cool. Ooh, The Eye of a Needle. The title has stayed the same. In some places they refer to it as The Eye of the Needle. Doesn't matter. This is the Eish HaTorah Kiruv Primer. Again, I'm working from the 1993 edition. I'm not 100% sure what changed from the later edition. And it's really a manual for people who are observant themselves, how to do outreach. But it serves our purposes because really it does qualify as an outreach book, and it's really available to anybody who wants it, whether you're observant or not. So I want to take you through the book a little and describe some of its methods and some of its ideas, and through that we can get a better understanding of how it's different from other types of books. Okay, so that's the cover, and let me give you the table of contents. I'm trying to be multi... I don't seem to have that. Okay, so we won't do that. I will talk you through it then, and I have some... here it is. The table of contents for the book, and you can get a feel for it. And again, I put this together myself to try to fit everything into this one little screen here. But from the table of contents, you can get a good idea of what it's all about. So the first section here, after the preface and the foreword and the introduction, is actually the truth is the introduction is very important. And I'm not sure if it's in the introduction or it's in this little piece called Gaining Confidence over here. It's by Reb Noach Weinberg. And Reb Noach Weinberg, just to get the book started on the right foot, talks about how the most important part of outreach is to show the excitement of living a Jewish life and how exciting and enriching and fulfilling and, you know, one of Reb Noach Weinberg's big ideas was pleasure. He had this whole lecture about the pleasure principle and how the true pleasure in life is about being Shomer Torah and Mitzvot. And that's how he sets off the book. But the truth is the book has nothing to do with that. That's just his little introduction by Reb Noach Zatzal. He passed away recently, unfortunately. And he was, of course, a major force in outreach, starting the Eish HaTorah Yeshiva. He was involved with Or Sameach. I think he might have helped found that also. And with all his lectures, he really brought a lot of people closer to Yiddishkeit. So the style of the book, and this is something really, the main reason we're talking about it, is the style of the book is to try to convince people that Torah is correct, which is through direct argumentation, meaning look at the issues, talk about them, and try to prove or convince, even if you can't prove it, if you can convince people that this is the most likely to be true, or the most rational, or the most convincing, then barring emotional issues and then social issues, you know, of course people are going to become firmer, or at least become more excited about their Judaism and more serious about their Judaism if they believe it's true. But it's difficult. How do you convince people? And that's something we're going to discuss a little bit at length here. I'm not going to go too much into any of their proofs or disproofs and how they go about doing it, but it is something that we need to keep in mind. Now, the first section, where, you know, tools for getting started in outreach, that's really inspirational. It's trying to inspire the people that it's addressed to, which is really people in the Orthodox community who they expect to do outreach on their on a personal level, not a professional level. So they try to inspire them and to give them strategies on how to reach out. And we're not going to go too much into what those are. It's very interesting, very helpful. You can see the little chapter names: gaining confidence, clarifying our own convictions, common misconceptions that alienate people from Torah, how to answer questions. It's strategic. It's to get the reacher out more comfortable with the job that they have to do. The second section is what I call the offensive section. This is where they go on offense. This is where evidence for God's existence in Torah and Sinai. This is where they try to prove and with direct arguments go straight to the topics and try to show you that what they're about to, that the Torah lifestyle is based on truths that are definable and provable. So they talk about evidence for Hashem's existence. Does God exist? Now, we're actually going to have a separate class just on that subject, because there's so much on that. It's a huge literature, mostly not Jewish, but there's also some Jewish literature also, and that's what I try to pull out. But we're not going to talk about that too much. But that's one of the things they do. They give one argument which they believe proves or shows or convinces that God exists. And then again, to have a religion, that's really the first step. That's how, if you're going to convince someone to be religious, the first thing they have to believe is that there's a God. Now, they might already believe that anyway. But either way, that's one of the important steps in convincing directly that Orthodox Judaism is correct, is you have to prove or show or convince that there's a God. Now, the second aspect of their proofs is Torah Misinai. How do they prove that the Torah is correct? It was given at Sinai to Moses, the Jewish people, and the Torah that we have is the Torah that was given. Again, they go through this through direct argumentation. They tackle it really, you know, with courage, courageously. They tackle it head on. This is a very important issue, and they don't dance around the topic. Now, the way they do it is, you know, the strategy in arguing. There are different ways of constructing an argument. So the way they do it is they construct two possibilities. They do it option by option. Here are two possibilities for one given case. Then they'll disprove the non-orthodox option. And then, once you disprove the non-orthodox option, which option must be correct? Obviously the orthodox option. They go through these types of arguments step by step. They show you two options. Disprove the one that is wrong, and therefore, which is right? The one that they're trying to argue in favor of. Now, this is actually negative argumentation. They're trying to not prove it directly. They're trying to disprove every other possibility, and therefore, when they do that, what they're arguing for must be correct. And in truth, is this is almost impossible to ever really prove, because they're endless. You know, human imagination is endless, and there are endless possibilities of what can be and what cannot be. So to give two options and to say option two is wrong, so option one must be right, is that really true? How do you know there's no option three, no option four, no option five, no option 100? So it's to make a foolproof proof, not so easy. Even to be convincing, maybe they can structure it and word it so that it's convincing. But if you take a step back and you think, well, maybe there are other options, you know, it doesn't leave me particularly overwhelmed. And the way I look at it and think about it is that, and we'll see this more in a few minutes, this is not the most sophisticated level of argumentation. It really only works on someone who hasn't thought about it too much and is unfamiliar with the literature and can really say, well, you put two options in front of them, you disprove one, that means the other one is still standing, that means they're not aware of any other options. If they're aware of any other options, they'll just stare you in the face and say, what are you talking about? You've only disproved option two, not three and four and five. So it doesn't work that well on people who have really studied the issues. On the other hand, how many people have really studied the issues? A minority of people. So when does this argument work? It does work on many people. It convinces many people because they have not studied the issue. And when you strategically plan what kind of arguments are you going to use, maybe you should be thinking about the one that appeals most to most people, and maybe this is the right kind of argument. I'm not saying it's the wrong kind of argument. I'm just trying to describe how it works and, you know, its pros and cons. And one of the pros is that maybe it works on the most people and the largest audience, and that's really what you want to appeal to. I'm not going to go into the details of the arguments, but I just want to compare. Let me see what documents I have here to share with you, my friends. Good excerpt. I believe this is the right excerpt. So this is one of their kinds of arguments about the truth of the Torah. So let me just read it out loud. You can see it in front of you. Furthermore, relying on the faithfulness and credibility of our Masorah, quotation marks, as a method of fostering commitment is not effective. Relying on the Masorah is not effective. Why? Since most secular Jews have not considered what Masorah means and how it truly is a substantive way of justifying our belief system, they cannot appreciate its value. Meaning just telling people to say, we have a tradition that the Torah is true. That's not going to convince anybody because they haven't bought into the system and they don't accept the Masorah, they don't accept the tradition. To them, I'm reading again, it seems like just another form of blind faith or tradition a la Fiddler on the Roof. I'm not sure what the reference is to Fiddler on the Roof. I mean, I know what Fiddler on the Roof is. I don't know why that's bad or good. Maybe unsophisticated because you think of this guy, Fiddler on the Roof. So let's keep reading. So there are two possible points in history when the Torah could have been given. Either at Mount Sinai, when the Torah claims it was given, or at any other time in history. So you see what they're doing? They're setting up two possibilities. So let's examine both possibilities. So I'm skipping A because there's a limited amount of time and room. Let's say Ezra the scribe, or King Josiah, appeared 1,000 years after the author's date of revelation and presented the Jewish people with the Torah. A theory certain Bible critics subscribe to. Okay, so let's say the Torah was given at the time of Ezra. Someone wrote it and said, here's the Torah. The people would ask, Ezra, where did you get this from? Ezra would say, read it. It says right here that God gave this Torah to the entire nation on Mount Sinai 1,000 years ago. Now, the Jewish people would ask, where was the story yesterday? How come we've never seen it before? My father or grandfather never mentioned anything about it. So what would Ezra answer? He would have to say that the event did indeed occur 1,000 years ago, as the Torah says, but that it was forgotten. So first, how could such an earth-shattering event, such as God revealing himself to an entire nation, be forgotten? And second, not only is it impossible for a religion and nation to forget its founding experience, but the Torah itself promises that it will never be forgotten. Therefore, they've disproven option B, so what must be true? Option A, it was given at Mount Sinai. Now, I'm not going to go through option B and try to disprove it. That's not my goal here. But I'm just saying there are other options in between option A and option B, and they're not even addressing that. So again, it's not a very sophisticated answer, but if you haven't thought about this, if you're not familiar with the literature or the way other people have thought about it and presented it, to you, you see option A, option B. B is no good, so it must be option A. Torah's given me Sinai. So that's not a very sophisticated argument, but to some people it might be convincing and it might teach them the truth. So maybe there's value in presenting something simplistic if people are simplistic themselves. But just to compare, I want to discuss just for a few minutes. It's not really our topic, but I think people might be interested. This is a Christian book, a book of Christian apologetics, called Reasonable Faith, Christian Truth and Apologetics by William Lane Craig. This is what you might call a fundamentalist book. It's by someone who is a Christian fundamentalist. And just by looking at it, you know, the reason I read it was to see if there are any tips that I could get as, I don't know if you'd call me an Orthodox fundamentalist, a Jewish fundamentalist, but someone Jewish interested in this type of literature and making these types of arguments. So the first thing that jumps out at me when I look at this book is that the guy's brilliant. He has two doctorates, which, you know, could mean nothing, could be doctorates from joke schools, but it's not. He actually is very brilliant. And his argumentation is on a very sophisticated level. He talks about, let's say, the first session. What he does is he shows a history throughout Christian history, different major thinkers who you've heard of, Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, you know, big people, what do they have to say about the conflict between tradition and reason, or faith and reason? Which is more important, faith or reason? And again, the book is called Reasonable Faith. He's trying to prove that his religion is correct. So this is an important issue for him to discuss, and he goes through it, and he does a decent job. I found it very fascinating, and the truth is I wish someone would do that about Judaism also, because he presents it very well. But he presents it on a sophisticated level. He presents it thinking historically, thinking critically. And again, for all the praise I give him, I think he's 100% wrong. I'm not a Christian in any way. I'm not a pseudo-Christian. And, you know, as we go through further sections, you'll see where I think he fails. But one of the second section is very important to us, because it's about the meaningless of irreligious life. Is it true? Is it not true? That's a separate thing. But what he does is he discusses it through a number of philosophers, and he tries to show that people who don't have religion in their lives are alienated from themselves. They don't have fulfillment. And their lives are generally not as meaningful as they could be if they had God in them, if they had religion in them. It's, to someone who's already convinced, it's a very meaningful chapter. To someone who's not convinced, I don't know how convincing it is. I don't know if it will change them, unless that person is someone who's not religious and is looking for meaning. And the truth is, anyone who's doing outreach, that's who you're trying to speak to anyway. The people who are not religious don't feel fulfilled in their lives. And what he's telling them through these major philosophers is that the reason they're not fulfilled is because they don't have God in their lives. I think that's a very powerful message to give. The Eye of a Needle gives that message to some degree, but only to a small degree. Not on the level of convincingness and sophistication that reasonable faith has it. The third section is really where he shines out, because the author's doctorate, or one of his doctorates, is in proofs for God's existence, and actually his main contribution to the field of philosophy was in that area, which again we'll discuss in a different class when we talk about proofs for God. But he has a very, very comprehensive discussion of the proofs for God, and he believes he can prove God's existence. Now, the truth is, he doesn't prove God's existence. But what he does is he discusses the proofs intelligently. And here's what I mean by intelligently. He gives one side, then he shows the other side, what are the counterarguments, and then he tries to refute the counterarguments. So already you know he's being honest and that he's showing that there are arguments against what he's saying. He's not saying what he's saying, everybody has to agree with me, this is the most obvious thing in the world, and I'm proving it 100%. He's showing that there's another side. And generally, this is just general life lesson that I think all of us already know, is that whenever you're discussing an issue, a controversial issue, think about what the other side says. What's their point? Are they a bunch of idiots? Probably not. So what is their point of view? At least try to understand it, even if you disagree with it. And that's what he's showing us, that he's not an idiot, because he recognizes there's another side. And then what he does is he tries to refute all their counterarguments. Is he successful? Truth is, no, he's not successful. I don't think so. I think people who might not be that familiar with the literature might think he is. But what he does is that he takes the counter-arguments and then he throws everything that's ever been written against him, every counter-argument, every refutation, and just lists them one after the other after the other, and basically throws in as much at them as possible to see what will stick. So it's sophisticated. I'm not going to go, you know, we have time limitations. I'm not going to go through the rest of the book because that's really Christian outreach and not Jewish outreach, but my point is that he's really writing on a college level. And when I compare the sophistication of his arguments to the sophistication of the Eye of a Needle, to be honest, it looks like an eighth grade. It's an eighth grade level versus a college level. It makes me kind of embarrassed. But again, we go back to the thing that I said before is maybe they did that intentionally. Maybe that's who they're reaching out to, because not that many people think on a college level. It's just a fact. A lot of people don't think that's sophisticated. So maybe that's the right way to go. But in terms of level of sophistication and level of argumentation, the Jewish book, at least this Jewish book, and I think it's representative of a lot of similar Jewish books, are not anything that I'm particularly proud of. Moving on to the Eye of a Needle. So it has another section after the arguments trying to prove. Let me pull that up, back to the table of contents. After trying to prove God's existence and trying to prove Torah Sinai, then they go to, right, that was the offensive, not the offensive, that was the offense, now they go to the defense. Now they discuss Judaism and contemporary issues. Well, how do people attack Judaism? How do people attack Judaism? What are the main issues, societal issues? And they try to answer them. So you can see right there, they discuss chosenness, they discuss women in Judaism, suffering. These are big issues. These are big issues that people reject Orthodoxy over. And I got to say, the section on women in Judaism is actually pretty well done. It gives what you might call the traditional point of view, which we'll discuss later when we get to Judaism, a way of God, Judaism, a way of being. But they do a pretty decent way of addressing that. again, if you're not sensitive, if you're not sympathetic to the traditional point of view, you'll just reject it out of hand. If you're a major feminist, you won't even bother. You won't take it seriously. But if you're sympathetic to it, you're more of a family values, so to speak, kind of person, then you'll take that section seriously. You have a section on suffering. So that's a major issue that's been bothering people since the beginning of time. You see it in Chumash already, in Navi, all throughout the Tanakh, throughout the Gemara. People, big rabbis, very famous Jews, have asked. They can't answer it. They can't answer, or not they can't answer, but they have questions about suffering. So the Eye of Anil has, let's say two or three pages on it, which gives you one approach, doesn't really give you the full breadth and depth of the Jewish response, but they give you something. They give you some sort of response, the same to chosenness, to free will. Again, you see there's a chapter on God's foreknowledge and our free will. This chapter is a few pages long, very, very short. Now, if you think about the literature that's been written on it, it's immense. There have been whole books, multiple books. You could put a library together on this. What they did is they tried to give a little about this. I just want to point out something else. They had two chapters here, one on the age of the universe, one on the theory of evolution. At least looking at the 1993 edition, I don't have the 2005 edition, the 1993 edition allows for an ancient universe, billions of years old, and allows for evolution, man coming, evolving, they allow for evolution, which to me I found surprising. After the whole Slifkin controversy, I believe Rabbi Slifkin is teaching actually two courses on Torah in Motion right now. So after the controversy surrounding his books, maybe they retracted that, maybe they changed that. But in the original 1993 edition, they had those controversial positions. Now, there's also a section here on how to teach, on being a chavrusa. And this is just socially very helpful, a lot of tips on how to learn with somebody if you have a beginner with whom you're studying a text one-on-one, so a lot of tips. For example, don't stick to the text. Allow for discussion. And then they have appendices. I don't want to go into that. I want to move on. Someone asked a question privately. I'm not sure why. Let me just give a quick answer. Okay, so let's move on to the next book because we spent a lot of time on the Eye of a Needle. Which, again, just to recap briefly, the Eye of a Needle is a book that tries to convince people. It's an argumentation, direct on argumentation. The next book we're going to look at is very different. Just want to switch back to the book list. So we talked about the Eye of a Needle, which was book one. Now we're going to talk about This Is My God from 1959. I said we're going to be discussing books from over 50 years ago, 1959. So that's when Herman Wouk, who was a playwright and an author, published his very eloquent description, and you can call it an outreach book, called This Is My God. Now, this is, I think, one of the best books on the subject ever written. And it's a little sneaky, because the fact that he's not a rabbi allows him to avoid some of the difficult discussions. He doesn't have to prove anything. So instead, what he does is he tries very hard not to argue. And what he does is that he describes Judaism, describes the Jewish life, and in describing that, incidentally, he covers all the major theological questions, all the major issues that anybody might have about God, about religion, about suffering, but he does it in a very incidental way so he doesn't have to argue. And every time he even does that, he says, look, I'm not a rabbi, I'm just giving my opinion. I mean, not literally, but he says, he doesn't try to be authoritative. He doesn't try to give a final answer. And I think it works. I think it really does work. So let me try to give you a few examples here. And then we'll discuss, I can't give you the table of contents because it's just so long. Even just the table of contents, there are over 20 sections. And there are four sections, and within each section, there are over 20 chapters. So I couldn't really give you that. But let me just read you briefly a description of how he deals with the overview of observing commandments. Because fundamental to Judaism is that we follow rules. And some of the rules are very detailed. Some of them seem to be symbolic. And some of them we just don't understand. Now, if you look in some of the explanations of the commandments, so many people try to give rational explanations for every commandment. The Rambam tried to give, and the Sefer Chinuch tried to give rational explanations for just about everything. Maybe they couldn't get all of them, but they tried very hard. You know, Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch and his Chariv tried very hard to cover all of them and to give rational explanations. Wolk doesn't try to do that. Instead, what he tries to do is to explain that Judaism is important, being Jewish is important, and keeping all the details are important. Now, why are they important? So listen to this. I think this is a great explanation. Once, I think I made a similar point. So you have to understand, Wook served in the Navy on a boat. So I had been a midshipman for a couple of weeks, and I was nailed with a demerit for incorrect use of words. I growled to my roommate as a tyrannical ensign walked off, "How will it help beat the Japanese if I call a staircase a ladder?" Right, he's in the middle of World War II. They're fighting, maybe not in battle right now, but they're preparing for battle. And he gets in trouble for calling a staircase a ladder, using the wrong term for some naval equipment. And, you know, he says, "Who cares? What does it matter to anybody whether I call it a staircase or a ladder?" So I eventually learned to do so. It is not my impression that I thereby advanced the surrender ceremonies in Tokyo Bay, say from September 5th to September 2nd. But I am pretty sure that I became a useful naval officer, in part, by learning the lingo. And whatever minute service I gave toward that surrender, I gave it as a naval officer. His point being is that all these details are part of being Jew, part of being the Jewish community, and there's a lingo to everything, there are symbols to everything, and he speaks about this in depth, how everything has a symbol, the symbolic language to every specialty, every expertise, and Judaism has a symbolism also. And if you want to be a good Jew, you have to master the symbolism, you have to master the terminology, just like to be a naval officer. Now, you might not understand all the details, but it doesn't really matter, because that is what being a Jew is about. And the greatness of Wook is that he's such a good writer, that he really evokes such passion and such rationality. And one of the things about Wook's book, again, is written in 1959. So 1959 was a lifetime ago. 50 years ago, the world was very different. And you can see in his book, when he is writing and to whom he is addressing, one of the major themes that keeps coming up is Marxism and communism, because again, that was 1959. And who was he arguing against? The communists, the atheists, who are communists, which to us, you know, that's world away. You know, I remember when the communism fell, but I'm sure some of the people here who are listening don't even remember that. They were too young if they were even alive. But certainly in 1959, we're living in the Red Scare, and one of the major issues was communism and also suburbanism. His book is superbly suburban. And it's also extremely polite and courteous and genteel. Because again, this was before the 1960s when people started disrespecting authority. The book is elegant. And to me, that's beautiful, and I love that, but I think it might not speak to everybody today. But nevertheless, just reading the book is really a snapshot out of time. So his second section of This Is My God is all about mitzvahs. It's about the Jewish lifestyle, the year, the seasons. He goes through every holiday, major and minor. And he shows, first of all, he explains to beginners. So if you don't know anything about Torah, you don't know anything about the commandments, he explains to you how to live through the holiday. But while explaining it, he describes the beauty of it and how great, how joyous it is, and such a wonderful life it is. And one of the things that he did here is he showed you could be a sophisticated, intelligent person and have a very fulfilling religious life while being an Orthodox Jew. So let me just read you a short sample from this about Sukkot. In American Jewish life, especially with the rise of suburban communities, Sukkot is recovering much of its old charm and excitement. Now, remember, if you live in the city, to celebrate Sukkot is very difficult. If you live in an apartment building, where's your sukkah? It's extremely difficult. I used to live in an apartment, and we had a lot of trouble every Sukkot. It was the same thing year after year. But if you live in the suburbs, you just build in your front yard, your backyard, on your porch. So, again, he speaks to suburbanites and trying to encourage them to celebrate Sukkot. So for the harvest time hut, the archaic word is tabernacle, is a perfect instrument for delighting and instructing the children. Those who mourn the absence of something like a Christmas tree in our customs have never given the sukkah a thought, or more likely have not heard of it. You can construct a hut in your own yard. There are portable, ready-made sukkahs which take most of the work out of the job. What is wanted is nothing more than 3 or 4 walls, some slabs of wood at the top, and the covering for the roof. Branches, boughs, grass, and reeds. Now, you see, he just gave you a little halacha there, but he slipped it in so that people know how to do it. But he didn't give you a long list, like we talked about last week, of all the halachas. He just gave you the brief rules. There has to be room in the sukkah for a table and chairs. Decorating the sukkah becomes a pleasant game of improvising patterns with fruits, vegetables, flowers, and anything else that adds color and gaiety. The small children dart in and out of the booth, playing some version of Cops and Robbers, as the children doubtless did in the hills of Judah 30 centuries ago when the sukkah was going up. So just there, just briefly, he goes through how it fits perfectly into suburban lifestyle, how it's perfect for family life, how it's joyous, and he gives you the basic rules to show you how easy it is. And this is the way he goes through the whole lifestyle, through bris, circumcision, death, the year, Hanukkah, Purim, Pesach, even Shavuot, Tisha B'Av. He explains everything very simply and elegantly. Now, the fourth section is really the most surprising one. I didn't even understand why it's there. I'm sorry, the third section. He talks about the development of law and how you go from the Bible to the Talmud to the Rishonim, the Achronim, the Shulchan Aruch, and to the law that we have today as ruled by contemporary authorities. Very surprising. He does it elegantly, not that sophisticated, but even surprising that he had it there. I think maybe he was subtly arguing against conservative Judaism, or maybe he's just trying to explain how the practices that we do, that he's explaining, how they came to be in this form. And I'm not really sure what that section is doing. And the fourth section is the most interesting, and that's about modern Judaism. And he talks about how the Judaism that he practices, Orthodox Judaism, how it came to be, and all the different flavors of Orthodoxy that were around in 1959. Hasidism was just making a comeback. And he explains Reform and Conservative, and this is where he explains why he thinks they're wrong, but he tries to be very polite. He doesn't argue against them. He argues in favor of Orthodoxy. And then, incidentally, you see why he disagrees with the Conservative and Reform. And that's really the best, most polite, again, 1959, he's trying to be polite, the most polite way to argue in favor of Orthodoxy. And I think today we have a lot to learn from that. I think it's actually still a very relevant chapter. And just as an addendum, in 1969, I believe, in 1987, he added sections to update it based on Six-Day War, and then developments in Israel, just to make it more current. So this is my God. Now again, so we saw the Eye of a Needle, which tries to argue and convince people that Judaism is correct, and then we saw This Is My God, which tries to describe the vibrancy of a Jewish life, and to make people understand that that kind of Jewish life and Orthodox life is not only is available and is possible for intelligent, sophisticated people. Okay, so let's go to the next book. That's A Letter in the Scroll by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. His official title now is Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. Here we go. Here's the cover of his book. There you go. It's a beautiful book. It had a different name originally when it was published in England, but this is the American, the U.S. edition, 1995, A Letter in the Scroll. Here's his table of contents. Again, we're running out of time. As usual, I overprepared and I took too long. Let me just tell you how this book came to be, because it's fascinating. And let me just also say that anybody who wants any of these handouts, I'm not sure how you can get it other than emailing me, gil.student@gmail.com. Email me and I'll send you whatever you need from all the handouts tonight. And if I could work with tech support in the future of giving it to you in advance, or at least making it available for you to download. I'm not sure if that's possible or how to do that, but regardless. So a bunch of college students came to the Chief Rabbi of England, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, and they talked to him about a project they were doing for a course. And they want to send out letters to famous Jews across the world and have them explain, why are you Jewish? So he worked with them. Okay, so it is possible for everybody to download this, or at least in the future. So he worked with them to put together a list of the right famous Jews and a list of the appropriate questions for each one, and they sent it out, you know, maybe 100, 200, I don't remember how many. And then they came back to a month later, and so he said, how'd it go? And they said they got like 4 or 5 responses, and most of them were like, I'm a Jew because that's the way I was born. Very, very disappointing. Nothing to learn there. So he said, you know what? I'm going to tell you my story about why I am Jewish. And that's how the book came to be. So you see the first section here. Part one, the question. So here explains what the question means through historical perspective, how people over time asked. And again, Rabbi Sacks is one of the most inspiring writers that there are today, Jewish writers at least. So with his eloquence and his profundity, he explains what the question is, why people in the past have wondered why they're Jewish and why we are wondering today. And then he gives an answer in that chapter called The Letter in the Scroll. And this is really the title of the book, and this is his main theme. And his main theme is like the Baal Shem Tov says that all of the Jewish people is like a Sefer Torah, a Torah scroll, and every Jew is a letter in that scroll. And his main point throughout the book and his main argument is that Judaism is the most radical, most incredible, most historical, most monumental human achievement. It has contributed to society again and again and still has much to contribute now and in the future. If you want to be part of that mission, if you want to be part of that incredible journey, you have to be Jewish, and Jewish in the Jewish way. And if you want to be Jewish in the traditional Jewish way, that's the way to become part of this timeless, monumental mission. It's an incredible, uplifting, positive idea. Just to be brief, so what we had so far is we had the Ivan Needle, which tries to convince people to be Jewish, to be Orthodox. We have This Is My God, which tries to describe the vibrancy of an Orthodox life. And then you have A Letter in the Scroll, which tries to inspire people about the mission of being an observant Jew. Now, the next book I want to discuss is by Professor Jonathan Cerna of Brandeis. He's a historian. His father was a famous Bible scholar. He is himself one of the most prominent historians of American Judaism in the world. He actually wrote a book, American Judaism, which is a fabulous overview of American Judaism in some 600, 700 pages. So he wrote the book in the form of letters to his daughter, but it's really just a rhetorical device. Where he's writing to college students who know nothing about Judaism, and he's trying to get them excited. So he goes through the Jewish year, highlighting all the holidays, all the events. I believe I have a table of contents to even show you. Here we go. So 13 different of their 12 months, he goes through 13 different events. And in each one, he tries to show, first of all, describe it briefly how it's fun and exciting, and how to show that there are theological issues and how each celebration addresses an issue of contemporary concern. So, for example, Yom HaShoah, the Holocaust Remembrance Day, so there he talks about suffering in the world. Rosh Hashanah, he talks about judgment. Sukkot, he talks about improving the world. Hanukkah, you always have to talk about assimilation and intermarriage, so that's where he puts it in there, the obvious place. But his main, and the most surprising thing I found about this book was that he doesn't actually argue anything. His goal here is to pique people's interest. He's talking to college students, and I look at this as a postmodern book of outreach. And that what he does is he tries to empower people, and he has that in that language. He tries to empower the reader to give them ideas and says, I don't have the answers. You study more and find the answers. And what's his strategy in doing this? This goes back to what we discussed in the beginning. Because one of the goals in outreach can be, if you choose, to get people more involved in their Judaism. Now, by piquing their interest and then sending them to the library, to the Beis Medrash, to the college class, the Jewish studies class, what he's doing is he's pushing readers to become more involved in their Judaism. And that itself is a goal. So with his book, he's not arguing, trying to convince people to be Jewish. He's not trying to inspire people to be Jewish. He's not even to do so much, a little bit. He's not really trying to describe the Jewish lifestyle. What he's really trying to do is pique people's interest and tell them that the things that are bothering you about life, your questions, college kids, the questions they have about life, all their answers can be found in Judaism. Go study. And so I found that a very fascinating book, and it's actually a very interesting approach. And many books, especially a philosophy book or a book about religion, is really talking down to the readers. No matter how eloquent and how sophisticated and how nice you might phrase it, really, the writer is teaching the reader something. So there's this imbalance. You have the writer up here and the reader down here, and the writer is speaking down to the reader. What he does is he puts everybody on the same level. He says, we're on the same level. I have questions, you have questions. All I'm saying is that let's study Judaism together and we can find the answers together. Which, to me, I thought that was great from what I understand. There are other books that do it that way, but this is the first book that I saw that does it that way. Okay, let's get to the book that we really came here to talk about. And that is Judaism, A Way of Being. I showed you the cover already. I'll just show it to you one more time. David Gelernter, he's famous because he was a victim of the Unabomber, and he got injured by the Unabomber, and still functioning very well. He's a professor, I believe, at MIT. He was a famous computer guy, came up with, I don't really know anything about it, but he was very famous. Here's a fascinating part about this book. The structure of the book is that he takes four questions that people ask about Orthodox Judaism. And how Orthodox he is, he says at the beginning, that's not an issue. You know, he's not out to have his scissors checked. He's just trying to discuss ideas here. So he has four complaints about Judaism, about Orthodox Judaism in specific, and that he wants to answer. And he has really four chapters. That's the main, the bulk of the book. And each chapter tries to answer one of these questions. So the first question is, why does Judaism have such intricate ceremonies and laws? So we saw Hermann Wouk's answer. Hermann Wouk's answer was, because that's part of being a Jew, is knowing the lingo and knowing the symbols. David Gelernter has a totally different answer. And let's just read it briefly, a brief excerpt that I came up with that I think has that. Okay, so that's not so easy to read. You can try to read it if you want while I talk a little bit. His answer is, the chapter is called Separation. And the goal of separation is that rising above nature, nature is about chaos, it's about things mixing together, what the Torah calls tohu vavohu. Everything is the same, everything mixes together, people, animals, plants, we're all the same, we're all on the same level, and part of rising above that is by separating. Through separation, you separate people from animals, you separate food from food, you separate times, you separate places, you separate objects. So here, let me read the excerpt now. To live by halacha means to use ritual acts of separation to create sanctity and thereby make life into one continuous act of sanctification. Sanctity requires separation between man and the beast inside, between our high aspirations and our animal nature. Halacha embodies man's defiance of the second law of thermodynamics in its physical and social shape. I believe that second law, that everything continues. Raised on the foundational imagery of birth and creation, halacha says, choose life in every law, every word, every letter. It embodies symbolically the Jew's defiance of chaos and death, his absolute refusal to rejoin nature. To rejoin nature and slide back into the meaningless sea of animal existence. Yes, anybody who wants can email me at gil.student@gmail.com, and I will send you out all these handouts and all these excerpts. I'm not going to read the whole thing because we're running low on time, and I want to run to a second question. So the first question is really the whole chapter. It's a very long chapter where he goes through many examples, and this is a very strong chapter where really he's taking, this is not a new idea. This is a very traditional idea, and really almost everything throughout this book is very traditional, very unsurprising. What's surprising is, number one, that someone would address it in such so modern a way. And the second thing is his eloquence and his imagery. David Gelernter is, I think he's an artist. He has some pieces in the book, some beautiful pictures. And he speaks with a language of imagery. And the truth is, to answer each question, he doesn't say, I'm giving you an answer. He says, I'm giving you an image theme. And he describes it in very graphic ways that really makes it jump out at you. And it's very elegant, very eloquent, and very contemporary. That's one of the beauties of it. So let's go on to the second one. The first one was, what's the point of all these ceremonies and laws? And the answer is to separate between time and place and object. And by doing that, you create sanctity, you create holiness. The second question is, how can a Jew understand and deal with a God as abstract and as indescribable as the unique God of Judaism? Right? God is far off, and we can't even see it. Not like the, you know, other religions have idols, have statues, have incarnations where they try to relate to God in that way. We have nothing. How are we supposed to relate to God that way? So to answer this question, Galinter comes up with a very unique, interesting idea, which I don't find 100% convincing. I think is probably the weakest part of the book. But his answer is what he calls the veil. And that's not the right excerpt. What he called the veil... here it is. The solution of this problem to the riddle and the paradox is an image. Imagine God and man face to face, but separated by a veil. There's the answer. Easy to picture, but far-reaching in its applications. Not an image of physical reality, but a hint about God's reality. If God and man face each other with a veil in between, they're face to face, yet not face to face. The veil allows transcendence and intimacy to coexist. It hides God's presence, but not his nearness. Okay, so let me give you, tell you why this is the most traditional answer that he could have given. So how do we say every bracha? Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech olam asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav. So we start out atah, talking to God. We're directly speaking to God. And then we say asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav. He sanctified us with his commandments. So we're talking to God, atah, or we're talking about him, asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav. So the answer given by the commentators, and this is widespread throughout the commentators, is that this is intentional. Because on the one hand, we have a direct relationship with God, the Atah, we're speaking to him. On the other hand, God is transcendent, and it's not someone we can see and we can relate to what face to face. So we have this transcendence and this intimacy. It's one of the contradictions, the paradoxes of Judaism. Yes, someone points out that Hashem is the third person, yes. Well, not necessarily. You speak to someone, you could use their name. I'm speaking to you, Yisrael. So that's one of the paradoxes. And what he does through his chapter is he gives a lot of examples of how that could be. Some examples aren't so great. He talks about the Western Wall, right? So that's very on a low place in between mountains, and you don't really see God, but on the other hand, you feel like you're right in front of God. So that's a good example. I'm not so sure. But let's move on because we're running out of time. So the third question, let me go back to the questions. The third question is one that is very, very relevant, and that is Judaism prejudiced against women? Oh my God, big problem. Isn't Orthodox Judaism anti-woman? So his answer, which I think is the strongest chapter in the whole book, is what is the chapter called "Perfect Symmetry and Asymmetry," something like that. Let me check here. The chapter is called Perfect Asymmetry, I'm sorry. And what he tries to show is a very traditional answer. Men and women are different. And that's what he says. Let's read it here. Judaism, male and female are perfectly asymmetric. They're different, but they're perfectly different. The force field between maleness and femaleness creates marriage and colors the whole universe. But the modern attempt to make the two sexes interchangeable, shorting out the battery that operates civilization, wiring its poles together, is an act of aggression against both sanctity and humanity. Is Judaism bigoted against women? No, male and female are different in body and mind. But each is basic to man's being. You need both men and women. They're different, but neither of them can be full without the other. And this is the Gemara, and this is a very traditional answer. But he said it so in such a contemporary language, which will offend people. It will not convince people who aren't sympathetic to it already. But what he does is he presents the traditional view in a very eloquent and elegant way, take it or leave it. So the assumption that women must do just what men do or be doomed to inferiority ipso facto betrays contempt for women and womanhood and puts men on a pedestal. His point is simply that men and women are different, they're asymmetrical. If men were like women or women were like men, the whole world wouldn't work. That's not the way God created us. Take it or leave it. Some people like it, some people won't like it. I personally think it's the most powerful powerful chapter in the book. The final, we're running out of time and I apologize, is an age-old question, the existence of evil. And what's his answer? So when I read the chapter, I wasn't sure the first time. I actually thought he was a heretic. And then I read it again and I read it more carefully and I realized, no, he's just saying a traditional answer. He said, what he says is God is not in history. Don't look to history for God. I said, whoa, what do you mean, don't look to history for God? It's one of the first of the Ten Commandments. Anochi Hashem Lokecha Asher Hotzeitzicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. I'm God who went into history and took you out of Egypt. How can you say God's not in history? But no, what he's saying is that after the destruction of the Second Temple, God hid his face. Hester Ponim. You read the post-Holocaust literature, what's the most common modern Orthodox response? The one that Rav Soloveitchik gave, that Rabbi Norman Lamb gave. Hester Ponim, God is hiding his face. So what he's saying is that post the destruction of the Second Temple, the reason evil exists is because man, humanity, is causing the evil, and God is hiding his face, which is a very traditional answer, not an easy answer. But he has a whole chapter trying to explain it and make it more palatable, not apologetically, but forcefully. This is what I believe, Galunter is saying. This is what I believe, why there's evil, and I don't think he believes he can explain every circumstance, every case of evil, but he tries to make a very good case. So let me just go back. We totally ran out of time, but I just want to sum up and give a further thought. So again, we looked at the eye of a needle. And again, if anyone wants these handouts, just email me. I put my email there, gil.student@gmail.com. So we looked at the eye of the needle, eye of a needle. We looked at this is my God. So the eye of a needle tries to convince people to be observant. This is my God tries to explain observance, thereby making it more of an option. Letter in the scroll tries to inspire people to be more Jewish, more observant. A time for every purpose tries to intrigue people, tries to make you curious. Judaism, a way of being, he tries to explain to the contemporary mind why he tries to explain what Judaism is about in separation, in the veil. But more than that, he tries to respond to people's objections. Okay, Jay Kelman tells me that I'll send him all the handouts and he'll put them on the Torah in Motion website so everybody can download it there. So the question is, which style works? Which should you do? If you have a friend who wants one book on outreach, which should you give him? Should you give him the one that tries to convince, the one that tries to explain, to make him curious? The answer is, I don't know. Different strokes for different folks. You have to. I tried to give you five different ways of doing it, four or five different ways, and it's up to you to figure out which one works best. And if you can't figure that out, give him all five. You know, there's nothing wrong with that either. So again, we ran out of time. I'm sorry. If you have any questions, feel free to stick on for after. If anyone sends me an email, I'll be glad to send them the handouts, or Jay Kelman. Jay will be putting it on the Torah Motion website. Here's Jay back here. Are we closing up shop now?
You can stay on as long as you want, and I recommend if anybody wants to actually talk, they can hit the talk button and speak to you or send questions, but... you know, however you want, it's open 24 hours a day.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much, Jay. Thank you, everybody, for sitting through this whole class, the whole talk. Someone asked when I'll be giving the Proof of God lecture. I don't know right now. I don't have... actually, I do. I wrote notes today on the back of it. So let's say today is the 2nd. So 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, the 7th class will be on Proofs of God, Proofs for God existence. So we're at 2, so you do the math. I can't do it right now. I don't have a calendar in front of me, and I have difficulty adding 7. But that's when we'll be. next week, we'll be talking more about Rabbi Sacks, Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. We discussed one of his books, The Letter and the Scroll. Next week, we'll be discussing 3 of his books, which is really just his view of the world. One of them was actually almost put in Cherem, so that makes it a little more exciting. But we'll be discussing his 3 recent books on how to change the world, his view for changing the world and changing the Jewish community. So if anyone has any questions, feel free to chat. I'll stick out for a few more minutes, and then we'll say goodnight. So thank you very much. If someone asks if This Is My God is still sells in stores, the answer is yes. Just go to Amazon. Actually, go to your local Judaica store, and you'll be able to find it there. But it is in print and in stores. Oh, is anyone buying it? I don't know. When I Googled it, I saw it all over the place. So I assume stores wouldn't have it in stock if people aren't buying it, but I don't know. Although I should say today I was in the elevator. I work at the OU going up with a former educator, and I mentioned that I'm giving this class tonight, and I mentioned This Is My God, and he told me how much he loved it. So it seemed, people seem to know all about it. It's a very famous book. And personally, I would recommend it to other people, because even though it's dated, it's 50 years old, it still speaks to me, and I think it still speaks to a lot of people. Yes, someone said, yes, it is definitely low-key. Does not slam you over the head, but I think it makes a very good case without making the case. And because, and the reason, because he's not a rabbi, he doesn't have to make the case. He can say, look, I believe what I believe, and I think it's okay. And he's so eloquent and so well-spoken that you think it's good. Okay, so, he says, Ivan Edel slams you more and uses apologetics. Yes and no. Apologetics, I don't know if that's bad or good. I don't really know what apologetics means. It can mean different things to different people. Apologetics means making the argument. That could be good. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make the argument, and yes, they are trying to slam you over the head. They're trying to convince you. Whether they're successful or not, that's a separate story. But if they are successful, then it's good apologetics. I've never read anything by Simon Jacobson. No, I get emails from him, but the truth is I don't even read that either, I think, from him. One of the Jacobsons. So the way you're using apologetics is that it's bending Torah to make it fit into modern sensibilities. Okay, they do. Maybe they do that to some degree. The truth is, a lot of people do that, and it's not necessarily the Haredim. I hear you saying, like, saying women are more spiritual. That's really just taking, bending the Torah as opposed to saying that they're different. I actually have to sign off now. It was a pleasure again. I'm sorry, I have to. Okay, just want to say Yona recommends Toward a Meaningful Life by Simon Jacobson. And thank you very much. And I wish everybody a good night. And Mirza Shem, we'll see you here next week.